If you're struggling in your career, business, or life, this podcast is for you. 9/11 survivor Ari Schoenbrunn shares inspiring interviews so you too can rise like a phoenix from the ashes to live your best life. Here's your host, Ari.
Welcome to Whispers and Bricks. My name is Ari Sherman and I'm your host. I have with me as a guest today, Hannah Studley. Amazing, amazing individual. You're going to hear her story. It's absolutely mind-blowing. And I know that she can help a lot of you out there. But Hannah Studley, she recovered from a severe PTSD after violent attacks in the UK and spent the next 25 years combining a very successful career in Hollywood with coaching and counseling people with trauma, addictions, and relationship problems. After graduating from the One Thought Institute in 2018, she noticed that her 25 years of chronic pain had completely gone, and so conducted research to discover if she could reproduce this experience in others. Following the success of 5 case studies, she developed a program called Painless and is now helping clients all over the world with all kinds of health issues and working with doctors and clinicians to introduce them to the quote unquote three principles. Hannah is also a World Health Organization psychological first responder, an international speaker, and author. Hannah's first book, The Myth of Low Self-Esteem, a novel about PTSD, Hollywood, and healing, came out last year and is available on Amazon. Her second novel, Painless, a novel about chronic pain and the mind-body connection, is also available on Amazon. Please help me welcome Hannah Studley.
Hi, Ari. So nice to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, thank you for agreeing to come on. I'm really, really excited because, you and I had a discussion before, and this is going to be one heck of a show. So let's not keep our audience waiting. Let's get started. You know, as you know, the name of this podcast is Whispers and Bricks. The whispers are those voices telling us what the right thing to do is, and they represent the good in life. The bricks represent the bad things that we go through in life. Now, we all know that there isn't a person out there who doesn't have a brick thrown at them at one point in time or another. Everybody does. Some are bigger, some are smaller, but everybody has it. Now, the reason I asked you to be on the show is because after I read your history, I knew that there were people in my audience who were going through some of the same things that you had gone through. They had been hit with brick after brick, much like what you had gone through, and they needed to hear and to know that they could get through the trials and tribulations the same way that you did. They need to know that there are whispers out there for them that can save them. Now, in your life, you've had many bricks thrown at you. Can you take us back to those troublesome years in Manchester and then London and tell us what happened and how you managed to get through that part of your life?
Sure. So I was actually mugged 3 times. You know, being mugged once is, pretty bad, but 3 times was really a terrible experience. The first time I was in college, I was at Manchester University. It was in the early 80s. And I was at a concert. A young man wanted to dance with me. I said, back off. I didn't know him. And I remember feeling his hand on the back of my head. And he smashed my head into a concrete pillar on the side of the dance floor. And that fractured my skull. And I was rushed off to hospital. I couldn't see because the impact had damaged the visual part, processing part of my brain. And my head is a different shape. It was absolutely terrifying. And because I was concussed and I couldn't see, I was flailing around. And the nurses actually had to put me in 4-point restraints on the x-ray table. Because, when you have an x-ray, you have to leave the room. So they were afraid I was going to fall off. So now I'm tied down, which is a trauma in itself.
Oh, my God.
And that was the first one. And it was kind of, we kind of not laughed it off, but I kind of got well pretty quickly from that because, when you're a student, these kind of things happen in Manchester in the 80s. that was kind of what happened. But about 3 years later.
Wait, let me ask you something. Did you go to the police? Did you report it? Did you do anything?
Not that one. No. I didn't know who he was. What was I going to tell them? And also, strangely, because nobody else knew what happened, I remember, I had a very close friend who, thank God, I'm still in touch with, 30 years later. And I was sitting on her sofa, and friends kept coming to visit because my head was so swollen that they all called me Melonhead.
Right? Oh, God.
Let's go visit Melonhead and see what color and shape her head is today. So I'm lying on the sofa, and some friends came over, and she was explaining to them what had happened to me because she'd actually come with me to the emergency room. And she said, oh, Hannah fell over. And I'm like, no, I didn't. That guy pushed me. And they all looked at me like, really? And this is like maybe a week, 10 days after the event. So really, it was a sexual assault. But because people just presumed I'd fallen over, nobody said anything. So that's kind of how it was kind of, dealt with.
I guess you didn't get very good advice.
No.
Okay.
No.
You know, sometimes the most well-meaning people just give us bad advice, not on purpose, you know, but it just happens that way. All right. Okay. Yeah. Next. So what happened next?
So after I left college, I moved out of the community where all the students were living. And the day after I moved, I walked back to pick up some stuff I'd left with a neighbor. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening. And in February in Manchester, it's already dark. It's cold. And I'm walking fast to get to see my friend.
How long after did this event take place? After the first one?
It was about 3 years in between, I'd say.
It was 3 years. Okay, go ahead.
So I was walking fast in the dark and near where I'd been living for the last, 5 or 6 years. And all of a sudden, out of the dark came three men who ran up behind me, slammed me on the ground and beat the living daylights out of me. I think they were looking for money. I can only guess. But it was so terrifying that I had what we'd call an out-of-body experience, which I think is quite common when people are in the middle of a trauma. It's kind of a defense, mechanism to deal with such a frightening thing. And I can remember it was almost like I was 30 feet above me looking down, and I could see them beating me. And I just almost watching it. It was very bizarre. And later, another way I'd remember it was like being deep inside of me and being like moved around as they beat me, kind of like a tree being blown around in a gale force wind. I could feel them pounding on me, but I was deep inside of myself, So it was, and I think that's also common with trauma, is like as the years go by, you kind of remember different things about it. You remember it differently. Different things kind of crop up to you. But what I remembered for the longest time, for the first, I could say 10 years afterwards, what I remember the most striking thing to me was I could hear my thinking, and my thinking was saying, if you can't catch another breath, they're going to kill you. Because I could hear myself screaming, and I could feel the air running out of my lungs. And I'm thinking, if you can't catch another breath, which is hard when someone's pounding on your chest and your stomach, I'm going to die. And the next thought was, if they have a knife, you're going to die. And that was how terrifying it was. It probably only lasted like a minute or two, max. But you kind of go into slow motion also in things like that. And then after they ran off, I kind of pulled myself up. It was kind of not a waste ground, but it was kind of in between two areas where houses were. It was like a bit of grassy area where the path was. And I remember pulling myself up out of the dirt, and I could see in the glow of a street lamp, I could see someone walking by on the other side of the street. And I never was angry or resentful that he didn't stop to help me, but it did kind of compound that kind of feeling of isolation and vulnerability and it was disposable and nobody cared, really. That's kind of where my thinking started to go. So yeah, I had probably a few cracked ribs and internal bruising, and my ears were pretty mashed up from like being, it's probably because I was screaming, they were kicking me in the head, and trying to stop me from making noise. But yeah, at least one, I've got a suspicion there were two people walking by and who didn't stop. Now, I've heard stories about people who stop to try and help someone who get into trouble themselves. So like I said, I didn't have a problem with that so much as I couldn't understand what was happening to me. And that
okay. So what did you do about that? Did you go to the police about this one?
I did, kind of reluctantly. Because what are they going to do? But I kind of, after a couple of days of like resting, and I kind of, needed to get out the house just to get, some milk or bread or something just to feed myself. I remember going towards the door, and my head was saying, last time you left the house, so they almost killed you. And so, like, you know, so going to going to the corner store the first time was like panic attacks the whole way. So going to the police station was like, do I really need to do this? And I thought, no, I want them to know what's happening. People need to know what's happening. So it took me a couple of panic attacks just to get to the police station. And I said, I want to give a report. And they invited me into an interview room and sat me down. And the detective was, you know, filling out the forms. And as I'm telling him what happened, what time it was and the date and everything, he said, well, we know who did it. I'm like, what? I mean, if it had been okay to reach across the table and strangle this guy, I think I would have done. Didn't want to get arrested. But he said, these three guys have been going around mugging women in the neighborhood recently. We know who did it. I wanted to scream, smack him. You know, I couldn't believe it. And I said to him, so why aren't you doing anything? You know, why don't you do something about this? He said, well, you know, we've got more important things to deal with. It was pretty much what he said.
Oh my God.
Because it was like a student kind of area next to a kind of druggy kind of, you know, not such a nice area. So they were dealing with, you know, gangs and I don't know, shootings and stuff like that. So a girl getting beaten up a bit is like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. So basically I was given a cup of tea, go home and walk it off. That was the treatment.
Oh my God.
Oh. It was like the early 1980s. I'd say that was about 83 or 84. And that's when PTSD actually went into the DSM. The DSM is the Bible, if you like, for psychology and psychiatry and social workers, how they, you know, dish out diagnoses. So a list of, you know, recognized diagnoses. And so in Manchester, nobody had heard of that. So like, I didn't get any support, any treatment. I did get some money eventually from from the Criminal Compensation Board, which was, you know, that was it. No kind of therapy or psychological support. You know, just my friends were amazing and supported me at the beginning, but then they moved on to the next thing too. And I was left with reliving that trauma and the thoughts that came with it.
Wow. Wow. All right. So that was two. Now there was another one.
Yeah. So when it came up to about a year after that event, and I could kind of feel myself getting really tense, like when I seen that date on the calendar come up, because I could tell you it was the second Tuesday in February. I've forgotten what year it was now, but I knew it was the second Tuesday in February. I was kind of like, you know, I was kind of getting ready for what, I don't know, but I thought, Manchester is clearly the problem. I need to move down to London. So I moved down to London, and that's where I started my career in the entertainment business, first working in like community arts theatre and then progressing to, you know, the Shakespeare Company and BBC and working my way up. But I just started working in a theatre. It was about 2 years after I'd moved to London. So this is like maybe 2.5 years after the second attack. I was riding my bicycle home late from the theatre one night, and I remembered noticing a young boy. He was probably, I think he was about 16. And I noticed him because he was on a little kid's bike, like a five-year-old's bicycle. And I remember thinking, why is he on such a little kid's bike? And the next thing I knew, he was off the bike. It came flying through the air and hit me in the head and shoulders. So because I was riding fast in that direction and the bike kind of, he threw it towards me, it was like, it was like being shot out of a cannon at a brick wall. The impact was ferocious. I fell off the bike, obviously, and into the path of oncoming traffic, which was amazing how a car didn't run over my head. It was a busy London street. And he took my bike from underneath me and made off with it. He sold it for about $70 the next day. And I know that because I kind of picked myself up and got to some friends who live nearby. And their daughter heard him bragging about it in school the next day. They heard him bragging about how he'd stolen a bicycle from a girl who was on the bike. He thought this was funny. And he almost killed me for it.
And what did you do about this, if anything?
So I wasn't keen on going to the police, because after the last experience, you know, like, you know, I was completely dismissed and, you know, shown the door with the last time. So what was the point? But I went to my family doctor, and he kind of moved my head around and said, oh, you're fine. Right. So I didn't even get an x-ray or anything. But my friends who I was visiting, because the boy found out that we knew who he was, he got a little, you know, scared we were going to report him. So he then set their garbage cans on fire. Now, they had little kids in the house. So, you know, my friend got very nervous and she said, Hannah, you've got to go. You've got to tell the police. You know, this is not just you now. It's like my family's, you know, in danger. So we did go to the police and I heard that he got picked up for stealing cars a few days later. So he then was in the system and, you know, that's the last I heard of him.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Wow. You know, it's bad enough. You know, most people don't get mugged once in a lifetime. You know, if they do, rarely is it twice, but three times. That's just amazing. I don't know. You had three major bricks thrown at you. Okay. And it's kind of like you probably was wondering at the time, like, why me? What is going on here? Right. I have to imagine now. But after that, it seems that you were you had some luck in the workforce. All right. Getting a job working in, you know, in entertainment and theater. And I think you mentioned to me you wound up in Hollywood. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it still amazes me how after that third one, I could barely get out my bedroom door, let alone out the front door. I was so terrified to leave the house, understandably. Right? I got into some pretty dark places, but luckily I finally reached out for help and some ladies got me, you know, back on my feet and really showed me the way out of that darkness. And so I started working on a job. I've always been self-employed. I've never had a proper job. and so I was doing a commercial. It was for Motorola. If you remember back then, cell phones were as large as a brick. You know? And it was a print commercial for Motorola that was going to be on billboards and in magazines. And we had to make some wings that were going to, you know, show that if you have a cell phone, you're free as a bird. Like little did we know back then how we would still be tied to something. And so on this commercial, I met a lady who had made a couple of movies. She'd done special effects with Jim Henson. So Jim Henson,
the Muppets, Jim Henson?
Yes, the Muppet guy. Wow. So Jim Henson, who made the Muppets, he had just passed away, but his son has been running the company ever since, Brian Henson. And they had a workshop in London. So my friend invited me to come and be her assistant. And so the first movie I worked on was the first Flintstones movie, if you guys remember that. It's funny, when I talk to teenagers and I tell them my story, they say, oh yeah, my mom told me about that movie. Yeah. Like, it's quite a few, it's like 30 years old now. Anyway, so we built all the animatronic puppets for the movie, the dinosaur and the Dicta bird and all those kind of special effects puppets that are in the movie. And so the main crew were flown out to LA to start filming, and I stayed, hung back in London and did some smaller projects. And then I got noticed that they needed to bring back the experienced people to start working on the next project. And I was sent to Hollywood to supervise all the creatures for 3 months of filming with Steven Spielberg, Elizabeth Taylor, John Goodman. That was my first movie, which is not too shabby.
Wow. That must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was quite scary at times because I'd never been on a movie set before. I really had to, like, you know, learn as I was going along. And I learned, I really learned a lot of, you know, things of how to basically make friends with everybody, because you never know when you're going to need their help. That was a good lesson I learned with that one. You know, you never know when you're going to need an electrician or a carpenter to come and help you fix something. And so, yeah, it was a big success. And I came back to London and started working on the next movie, which was Babe, the talking pig movie. And that took us to Australia, and we got an Academy Award for that one. So it just kind of went like that, each movie, you know, going on and doing more and more weird and wonderful and amazing things with incredible people flying around the world. What a privilege that was.
Wow, that's like, you know, I mean, I wonder, do you look back and say, you know, maybe the three muggings is what, you know, prepared me for my greater success? In other words, I had to suffer a little bit beforehand, all right, before I was able to attain this success. But at the end of the day, you attained some very, very interesting success.
Yeah, I mean, it really did. You know, I really felt that it's not that I learned to be a survivor, but I learned not, you know, I would kind of give up. you know, and I'd think I can't do this anymore. And then I'd pick myself up and then I'd get beaten down again. But what I started to realize is when you're more living in the moment, because I think, you know, when you survive kind of traumas like that, it kind of brings you back to really valuing here and now when I got well from it. That each job I was doing that was brought to me was an opportunity to grow and share. And I should also say, in between those movies, I was also coaching and counseling people. I trained as a counselor back when I was in college. And so, you know, because of the kind of very specialized work I was doing, it was very common to have maybe 2 or 3 months off in between each project. So I would do, you know, volunteer work with the Boys and Girls Club, or, you know, like different organizations that provide support for, you know, people who've been through trauma or, you know, other kinds of problems. So it kind of kept my feet on the ground, because when you're working in that kind of movie environment, you can imagine it can get a bit, it's a bit seductive, you know?
Yeah.
So I saw how by helping people in between, it was really keeping me in a place where, you know, being real, as it were. And eventually I started to see that what I'd been through, I could share with other people. So the confidence I was getting at work, combined with the coaching experience I had with, you know, working with other people who were still suffering, it kind of, yeah, it's turned my life into something, you know, really worthwhile, and gave me something to live for. Whereas before I was like, what's the point?
Wow. So we had discussed this before, I think, but you ultimately wound up obviously in Hollywood. All right. And what many would consider a dream job. Okay. But with everything, you felt that your life was empty, even though you had all this, you had, you know, this, I don't know, fame, fortune. I don't know if you had fame and fortune, but just the thrill of being in Hollywood and working on the sets and working with all these famous people. But you still felt empty. So tell us a little bit about how you found your high, let's call it a higher calling, because you did find some, ultimately you found something that was going to fill that void.
Yeah, it was interesting because, yeah, like you say, that what I had was what so many people, you know, dream of and work very hard to get. And I was at the top in my career. You know, if a movie needed a talking animal or some kind of that kind of special effects, then I was, you know, I was doing that work. And
you were the go-to guy for that kind of work.
Yeah, you need a talking tiger, I'm your man. Right? Yeah. So, like, I made a set of wings for John Travolta for a movie called Michael, and they became the gold standard for wings in Hollywood for many years. Like, Al Pacino wore my wings, Michael Jackson wore my wings, you know, Claire Danes wore them. And and, you know, as I became more more spiritually awake and more grounded in you know, myself, I started seeing that, you know, this kind of fame and fortune stuff that I was so seductive and I was chasing like everybody else. I just started feeling very empty. And I started thinking, well, I mean, I was lucky that I worked on mostly children or like family type movies. I wasn't, you know, a lot of my colleagues were working on slasher, you know, horror type stuff as well, because it's the same, you know, same materials, special effects, doing that stuff. But even though I was working on mostly children's movies, I still felt like I should be doing something a little bit more worthwhile, because you could be working 100 hours a week on these things and like you don't get to see your family, or you've, you know, it's hard to have a life when you're working so hard. And I started thinking, well, maybe I should do documentaries, you know, maybe I should do something a bit more, you know, like has a bit more value to it. And for about 2 years, I was kind of playing with these ideas of leaving, or what should I do? I've only ever worked in film. I don't know what else to do. And we used to call it the golden handcuffs, you know, it's because it's like, okay, I'll do another movie. If it's with Brad Pitt, I guess I'll do it, you know. And with that, I mean, seriously, my last movie I did was with Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts, and, you know, like, okay, I'll do it. You know, that's, you know, it's very seductive. And then after that movie, I was just so drained. I was exhausted. I'd actually found out when I was in Australia that my neck was broken. When that kid threw that bike at me, my neck had been broken. I didn't know it at the time. I walked around with a broken neck for 2 years. And I then had chronic pain for 25 years from my neck injury and then from my lower back. And I was fighting with that all the time. My back would go out. I would, you know, I was paralyzed a few times. I was rushed off to the emergency several times. And so by that last movie, I was in such pain in my back. I started realizing, you know, maybe I should be doing something else. And so I just kind of, I remember the last movie I was offered was called Stuart Little. It was about a little mouse. So I was offered the job of supervising all the special effects on that movie. And it's a beautiful story. It's so cute. I mean, what they did with it was amazing. And I remember looking at the phone and, you know, thinking, I need to call the producer and tell her I can't do it. And I won't say it's the hardest phone call I've ever made, but it was certainly a significant one, because I knew as soon as I made that phone call, that was it. My career was over, because there are plenty of people who want to take my place.
Right.
You know? So I called her and I said, I'm really sorry, but I can't do it. It's almost like my hands wouldn't do it anymore. You know, for a couple of years, I've been thinking I shouldn't be doing this. And then it was almost like the talent was taken away and I couldn't do it. And I stopped. And for a little while, I was like, okay, now what? You know, and then that's when I started teaching and then turning to coaching full time and started working, first of all, as a trauma coach. And then later the chronic pain kind of came into it. And that's kind of more what I'm doing now.
Right. But I remember you telling me, first of all, you're Jewish, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Just like me. Okay. And I think you mentioned something about you weren't a practicing Jew, if memory serves me correct. You didn't know much about it. And then things changed. What happened?
Yeah, because I was going to, you know, in America, what's called a Reformed temple. In England, I didn't really grow up that, but it was kind of appealing to me, because you could, you know, that you could do whatever you wanted and go to temple and meet people on Saturday. And I was, you know, my temple had people like Dustin Hoffman and David Mamet. And, you know, like it was cool and trendy. It was spiritual, you know, like you do your meditation, you do your yoga, you go to temple, you know, it was like a cultural thing. And then I started getting kind of more curious. I wanted something deeper, something stronger. And the rabbi of that Reformed temple gave me a book, which, you know, it's called, in Hebrew, it's called Mesilat Yesharim. It means Path of the Just in English. And I was so taken by this book because it was really about, in Hebrew, it's called Musar, but in English, it's like self-development. And because of the coaching and counseling work I've been doing, that really appealed to me. So it was kind of like, you know, my cultural and, you know, religious heritage was coming together with the work I was doing. And I was just in love with it. And so that searching part of me took me to a more, you know, observant lifestyle. And then I know that eventually led me to coming here to living in Israel, where I've been now for 10 years.
Wow. That's amazing. So you go from being mugged three times, living in Manchester, living in London, then going to Hollywood, Australia, around the world, doing all these things. All the while, probably you probably didn't even realize it, but you were searching the entire time because you were trying to figure out what is going on, and you kept searching. But very often you kept, you know, you weren't listening to those whispers. You were getting hit with brick after brick after brick, and you weren't listening to the whispers until finally, when you made that decision, when you said, I am done. Finally, the whispers got through to you and said, look, you know what? You need to listen to me. And you did. And that led you on that path that you left a life of, you know, great physical achievements, but spiritually you were totally void. And, with your curiosity and the like, and meeting the right people and having, you know, just people from different walks of life who said to you, hey, try this, try that. And then it just leads you. And now I'm assuming you're an Orthodox Jew, correct? And you just left everything. You left your entire career, right? The whole Hollywood thing. And you moved to Israel, all right, where you gain more spirituality. And the next thing you know, your coaching is better. You're doing things that you really love. You're doing things that you know is important. And it's not only are you helping others, but every time you help others, you're helping yourself as well. And that is totally, totally amazing. I hope my audience understands what you went through and what the ultimate, you know, what, where you wound up at the end. So I would say to the audience, if you're going through stuff, okay, just listen to Hannah Studley, all right? Because she's been going through all kinds of stuff, but she realized what was important in life. And she followed those dreams that she had to become a better human being. That is absolutely amazing. So now you're what? You're doing coaching?
Yeah, I primarily coach now. And like I said, I was doing a lot of work with trauma, which I still do if people need that. But because of my chronic pain, I got curious because my pain actually went away. You said in my bio in the introduction, I'm actually what's called a three principles practitioner. And these three principles are kind of a new paradigm in psychology. And I came across this about 6 years ago, and I was so taken with these ideas. I got so excited about them that I went to London to do some training. And because of the expense of the course and flying backwards and forwards, you know, I had to go there several times, and the studying and the traveling, I needed to save some money. So I'd been going to the chiropractor for 25 years, right? Since that doctor in Australia, when he treated me, when I discovered I had a broken neck, he said to me, you're going to need to have treatment for the rest of your life. So for every month for I thought was going to be the rest of my life, what turned out to be 25 years, I was going to the chiropractor, and I'd have flare-ups in between, and I would see the chiropractor even more, you know, and more treatments. I was never very far from an ice pack or a heating thing or, you know, massage, that kind of stuff, because of the tension in my back and the tension, my arm would go numb sometimes. You know, I'd lose the power of my legs. I had sciatica pain shooting down my leg. And after I finished this 6-month course, I suddenly noticed my pain had gone away. And I was so intrigued by this that I wondered if I could recreate this in other people. So I got 5 volunteers and I put together a kind of program, sort of like, you know, using the ideas that I'd learned, combining it with a lot of pain science that I was now really enjoying reading, because it was fascinating to me. And I developed a program, and these 5 volunteers started to get better. They started to see that we're always feeling our thinking. Now, when I was in the depths of my PTSD, I was feeling my really bad negative thinking. And so I was feeling terrible. And then as I started to come out of that darkness and like with guidance of some amazing people and the, you know, the benefits I was getting from the work and, you know, and then moving here and all that spiritual work, my consciousness is rising up and I'm feeling better. We're always feeling our thinking. And I think for some of us who have chronic pain, we're kind of feeling that thinking in our bodies. My body was sending messages to me, they were kind of like the whispers, if you like, that I was getting. Like, you know, first it was the physical assaults I was getting that were like these bricks. And then the whispers I would say now are like my body's saying to me, slow down, slow down. You know, and the back pain and the numbness and I, you know, it's not just back pain. People, my clients have Ari, I apologize, I have to stop. My cat has just escaped and I have to get him. 1 second.
All right, Kelly, you'll have to edit this part out, okay?
On the air conditioner and about to jump 4 floors down and break his neck. I do apologize. So the whispers I was getting from my body, they were telling me to slow down, that my busy mind I was trying to fix my environment for a long time. And then I was trying to fix my thinking. And as I realized my thinking doesn't actually need fixing, that thinking is always flowing and moving, that I'm actually not broken, there's actually nothing wrong with me. That's when I think that's when my pain went away. And that's what I'm sharing with people now, is that you're not broken. You don't need fixing. And like, God doesn't make garbage. You're perfect just the way you are. And that, those insights have been enough for my pain to go away and a lot of the people I've worked with. And other parts of their lives start getting better too. You know, relationships get better and, you know, like business gets better. My coaching practice has gotten better. It's incredible.
Wow. That's amazing. All right. So let me ask you, we're going to wrap this up. If people want to get a hold of you, all right, if they want to, you know, talk to you or join your program or anything like that, what's the best way to get in touch with you? Do you have a website? Do you have an email address? What have you got?
Yes. So I have a website. It's my name, hannahstudley.com, which is spelled C-H-A-N-A-S-T-U-D-L-E-Y.com. It's the same for the email address. It's hannahstudley@gmail.com. I'm on Facebook. You can find me there. I actually have a Facebook group, which is a whole wonderful discussion about these ideas. And it's called TMS, The Three Principles in Chronic Pain. And I'm about to record an online program. I've been doing a 10-hour program for like the last couple of years where I discuss things with people, but the science that I've been reading, I'm finding I want to record it and put it into an online program. So that's something to look forward to. The two books, like you said, are on Amazon. I'm in the middle of writing four more.
Four more?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like once my thinking slowed down, even things like me saying to myself, I'm not academic. You know, some people say, I'm shy, I couldn't do what you do, I'm not academic. I realized that I can write. And so now these ideas for these stories, because my books are actually novels, they're fiction. Because I think often, you know, people aren't like me, they don't always want to read textbooks and research papers. So I found by putting these stories and these ideas into fiction and into with characters who can, you know, do the searching and do the falling down and the getting up and the discovering and the healing. You know, you follow these characters go through these adventures and these traumas and getting well at the other end. I think people find that a lot more easier to read. And, you know, because everybody loves a story, it's much more engaging. So the first one was about trauma. The second one was about pain. And I've got a book on hormones and menopause on the go. I've got a book on abuse and one on ADHD. They're all novels. They're topics where people are suffering. And I want to share the information that has been given to me so that they can have insights and get free of the old ideas and what they've been through.
Wow. Okay. That's great. So if you want to get a hold of Hannah, you can go to HannahStudley.com, HannahStudley.com. Or if you want to email her, it's HannahStudley@gmail.com. And she'll be more than happy to work with you, talk to you. She'll guide you. You know, if you want to get into one of her programs, I'm sure she can help you out to make a decision as to which program you would fit into. She's really, really great. I'm so happy. Hannah, thanks so much for sharing your story with my audience. I'm sure you've touched the hearts of many people in my audience. Good luck going forward. Keep up the good work. You know, keep helping people. And, you know, God will bless you. He certainly will. You've been listening to Whispers and Bricks, and I'm your host, Ari Shomer. Until next time, listen to the whispers, avoid the bricks, and never, ever give up on your dreams. Bye for now.
So that's it for today's episode of Whispers and Bricks. Head on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show. One lucky listener every single week that posts a review on iTunes will win a chance in the grand prize drawing to win a $25,000 private VIP day with Ari himself. Be sure to head on over to whispersandbrickspodcast.com and pick up a free copy of Ari's gift and join us on the next episode.